Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about race, and in the last audio clip, we began to speak specifically about Black America, and we're going to continue on that topic. Last time, we began to talk a little bit about slavery in Africa. Or around Africa or and around the world in general terms to provide a greater context that is usually not provided by people when they talk about the issue of slavery and how it relates to Black America. And we saw how common slavery was, and that not only were Black people enslaved, Europeans were enslaved by other people, like the Barbary pirates and so forth. And we saw also how the Arabs had a great role in enslaving people and engaging in slave trade. So it's not just the evil white European, quote unquote, who engaged in slavery. There were other people who engaged in it in a very strong way. So we were trying to fill out the context of how slavery was present in ancient times and in Africa, even before the arrival of the Europeans and the Atlantic slave trade. So this time we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about the Atlantic slave trade. And that's the name that's given to the trade that brought a lot of slaves from Africa, Black slaves from Africa to the Americas. And a lot of people called it the triangular trade because it was like a triangle between Europe, Africa, and the Americas. In Europe, ships would stock up on a lot of supplies, a lot of or goods that they would then take down to Africa and then trade those goods with the Africans, Black Africans, to buy slaves from them, and then they would ship the slaves from Africa to the Americas, where then they would sell the slaves and get goods from the Americas, and then they would finish the triangle by taking those goods from the Americas and taking them back to Europe. So there was this trade that was going on, and that created a lot of economic activity in a certain sense, because the Europeans were producing goods that were being sold, and then indirectly through the slave trade, they would get goods from the Americas. So that was the trade that was going on. And the trajectory from Africa to the Americas was called the Middle Passage in that triangle. As we said before, the Portuguese were the first who began to engage in slave trade. And they began it when they established what they called the Estado da India, which was like their Indian territory that they controlled in India in the early 16th century. So they needed, they needed, and I say that in quotes, or they perceived the need to have slaves to work the land and do things in their Indian territories that they conquered and took control over. So they started looking for slaves to ship off to that part. And a lot of the first slaves came from the area that is modern-day Mozambique, the country that is right in front of Madagascar. right near South Africa, but on the eastern side of the African continent. And so that's how it started. And then eventually, when the Portuguese felt that there was a need for more labor in Brazil, their colony in the Americas, then they began this massive shipment of slaves from Africa towards Brazil. And the first voyage to Brazil was around 1526 with slaves there. And then they just began to send them on a constant basis to work the sugar plantations and so forth. At one point, back in those days, Brazil was became the biggest producer of sugar in the world. And a lot of that was through manual labor by slaves. And one of the reasons why the Europeans, and in this case the Portuguese, felt the need for slaves in the Americas was that the Europeans were not used to the hot climate, the hot tropical climate, and the diseases associated with that, like malaria and things like that. At the beginning in Brazil, they used the indigenous people, the Amerindians in Brazil, to do the labor, but then they started relying more and more on black slaves from Africa, and they perceived that those black slaves, having grown up in hot weather to begin with, and had having already been exposed to diseases like malaria, and therefore having a natural immunity towards it, they realized, oh, these people are better suited to work in this environment that is unfriendly to us, and they can withstand the labor and produce. So that's how they started looking for slaves. And Portugal was the Portuguese were the European nation that transported the most slaves to the Americas. And one thing to consider also is that a lot of them, of the slaves who were brought to the Americas and to Brazil specifically, a lot of them died on the way to Brazil, and you know, because of the terrible conditions in the ships that transported them, and also they were not well taken care of, and therefore they needed more and more slaves from Africa, which was a bit of a different situation here in the colonies, the British colonies, you know, which became the U.S., where there was not as much of a need for a constant influx of slaves from Africa. They were still coming in, but it was not as strong as Brazil, because the weather in North America was less harsh, you could say, than the weather and the conditions in South America. So fewer slaves died whilst working the land here as opposed to Brazil. So that meant that they didn't need to import as many. And also, for some reason, in the U.S., or in what is now the U.S., the slave population had a better chance of growing organically, if you can call it that, you know, black slaves having children and the children having children and so forth, that the multiplication of the black population, black slave population, was much better here in the U.S. Than in other parts of the Americas, that is, I guess, in part due to the less harsh climate and other conditions. The thing is that explains in part why the Portuguese were the ones who transported the most slaves, and most of those slaves ending up in Brazil. As we said before, if I'm not mistaken, unlike other Europeans, the Portuguese participated heavily in the rounding up of slaves. The other European countries or people would not engage as much actively because of malaria. The Europeans were not as well suited to stay in Africa for too long because of diseases that they were not used to. But that was before quinine came into use after it was discovered in South America by the Spaniards around the start of the 17th century. So the Portuguese were the first to engage in the slave trade. In second place come the British. They transported the second most number of slaves to the Americas. And it's worth noting that the first Africans, black Africans, who were taken as slaves were taken in as indentured servants. And they even had some certain legal standing similar to that of contract-based workers from Britain and Ireland. But eventually they went from that status of being indentured servants to being full-blown slaves that were treated as property. So the British began to engage in the slave trade, bringing all these black Africans to the British colonies, which is now the U.S. And the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, and the Danes also transported slaves, I believe in that order, after the Portuguese and British. And it's interesting to consider that the Danes were involved in the slave trade. Most people would never think that they had that Denmark had anything to do with slavery, but they were also involved in that slave trade. And now that we've mentioned that, it's also worth noting that as the Europeans were engaging in this slave trade, they were not, as many of us would imagine, based on the little information, the little education we get on slavery, which is sad considering how big of a topic it is all the time, that the impression we most of us would get is that the black Africans in Africa were just these noble tribesmen and tribeswomen with their spears and doing their sheep herding and cattle herding and whatever, and that they were living in this idyllic state of peace, maybe not as technologically developed, but they were just living out their lives calmly, and then suddenly the evil white cracker showed up and started rounding up all the slaves and kidnapping them and taking them on their ships and bringing them to the Americas. So the perception is that Africa was this land that of people who were just living out their lives, and that there were these little tribes here and there. But that's not really the situation. It's a very false narrative that we kind of fail out in our heads because of the lack of information. You have to remember, Africa is not like the Americas. The Americas remained kind of isolated from the rest of the world up until the Europeans came to the Americas and made something out of the Americas. Because it really was going nowhere, the way the Amerindians were handling things. And just so you can get an idea of why I would say such a dramatic thing, just remember, they didn't even know about the concept of the wheel. It's historically known that there's been evidence of the wheel already being used in Sumer, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, but Sumeria, you know, where in Mesopotamia, the Sumerian civilization was using the wheel around 3500 BC. So when Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492 and showed up, and the Europeans started showing up, that was 5,000 years later. And in 5,000 years, the Amerindians, it never occurred to them to use a wheel to transport things, you know, on chariots or whatever. They didn't, that's how backward they were. And if they had remained isolated, they would have stayed in the Stone Age, literally. I would dare say even to the present day. But the point that I was trying to make is, or emphasize, is that the Americas were isolated. So there were these people who were living in this backward world without contact with other better, more advanced cultures and civilizations. But Africa was not like that. Africa was in the heart of human history. They had the Middle East, you know, Israel, Egypt, you know, the Egyptian culture, it was in Africa. Egypt is in Africa. Contrary to popular belief, Egyptians are Africans. As I've said before, if an Egyptian comes to the US and becomes a US citizen, he can be called an African American. But even if he is Arabic in ethnicity, so that's why the term African American is such a stupid term for other reasons also that we shall talk about hopefully in other audio clips. But the thing is, Africa was in the middle of human history. They had constant contact, literally, with Europe. The Roman Empire had a province in Africa. They controlled large portions of Africa. So they were acquainted with Roman law, the Roman system, the Roman way, the law and order, and all those things that came with the Romans. They were in constant contact with the religions of the Middle East, the monotheistic religions, you know, like Judaism. As you know, Ethiopia had a strong Judaic population of black Jews, black people who had adopted Judaism. So they were in constant contact with all the with everything that was going on in the world. So Africa was not this little idyllic land that was sparsely populated with a few tribesmen here and there. They had kingdoms. By some counts, it's believed that there were around 173 city-states and kingdoms in the African regions that were, you know, involved in the slave trade between around 1502, when it all kind of more or less started, and 1853, that 350-year period. And 1853 is mentioned, we're mentioning it here because that was the year when Brazil became the last Atlantic nation, import nation to outlaw the slave trade. So it took Brazil up until 1853 to finally outlaw the slave trade. And that's when slaves stopped coming to the Americas or to Brazil from Africa. But during those 350 years, there were 173 city-states and kingdoms in the African regions that were involved in it. In other words, the Europeans were not just landing you know, in these places that were ungoverned by anyone and just simply rounding up blacks to bring them to the Americas. When the Europeans would land in Africa, they would land in a country, you know, the equivalent of what we call a country now, a kingdom, a city-state with a king, with a ruler, with a political system, and their own army and things like that. And out of those 173 city-states, at least 68 could be considered to be what we would call like a nation state with a political and military infrastructure that would allow them to kind of like dominate their neighbors or conquer neighbors and establish control over territories. And nearly every present-day African nation had a pre-colonial predecessor. And again, there were African countries, African kingdoms, and some of them were not just, you know, little kingdoms, they were empires. And we mentioned the other in the other audio clip about the Dahomey Kingdom, which was a pretty relevant kingdom in what is modern day, I pronounce it Benin. I don't know if that's how people pronounce it, but I pronounce it Benin, B-E-N-I-N. And it was a pretty powerful kingdom, and we spoke about the atrocities they committed. They had this annual ceremony where they would just sacrifice, do human sacrifices just for the hell of it. But they were a powerful empire. So it's interesting to consider also that when they had slavery before the Europeans arrived, but once the Europeans started showing up and engaging in slave trade, some of these nation states, African states, run by black people with black kings and, you know, a black police and police force and so forth. Many of these states began to change their legal code so that certain crimes would be punishable by slavery, being sold into slavery to the Europeans. So in other words, when they saw that the Europeans were coming and trading for slaves and things like that, many of these city-states decided, okay, to deter crime, if someone is, I'm just making this up, and just to give an example, if someone steals 10 cows from his neighbor, then the punishment will be, instead of going to jail, the punishment, to prison in Africa, the punishment was to be taken and sold as a slave to the Europeans. And they would put that in their legal code. So the thing is that it became institutionalized and run by these African kingdoms. And as we more or less started to explain before, these African kings would engage in fights with other kingdoms nearby, quarrels and trying to take control over more territory and so forth. And when they would defeat their enemies, then they would take they would use that as an opportunity to get slaves from the defeated enemy to sell them to the Europeans. And the Europeans would give them goods and services. And that's another thing you have to remember. The Europeans were not just showing up in Africa and just kidnapping black people and bringing them to the Americas. They were buying them. They were buying them with goods and services from Europe. So the slave trade began with black people selling other black people to the Europeans. And then the Europeans would sell the black people to white people or whatever, other Europeans in the Americas. But the thing is that it was institutionalized, and a lot of these nation states, like the Dahomey Kingdom and others that we will mention, they rejoiced in the slave trade. They saw it as a good thing because that enriched them, provided them with goods and services that were coming from Europe and making their kingdoms richer. And they would rejoice at the opportunity of weakening their enemies when they would defeat them, and then they would take their men, women, and children and sell them to the Europeans. That made their enemy weaker because then their enemy would have fewer people to fight against them. So they rejoiced in this. This was business. This was good business for them. And it's also interesting that these kings or leaders, in many cases, would offer their wives in marriage to the European traders to forge alliances. So a lot of these European slave traders would take the daughter of a king in marriage, and then and say, okay, now we're now we're going to work with you exclusively to do our slave trading, and we're going to give each other discounts or whatever they would do. And the point of saying this is the African leaders, African black leaders, were aligning themselves with the European slave traders, even offering their daughters in marriage in order to secure the trade because it was profitable to them. And some of these kingdoms were very became very adept and brutal at the practice of enslaving their enemies and selling them to the Europeans. And just to give you an idea, in letters that before we mention what we was about to mention, let's mention that some of these kings were not completely in favor of slavery, these black African kings. And one of them was, for example, the Manikongo of Manikongo is like a term to me that means it's like Pharaoh to Egypt. The Manikongo was to the Congo Empire. In other words, Manikongo must mean something like King of Congo. So the Manikongo, who at the time was and the name was Nzinga Mbemba Afonso. At least that's how I would pronounce it. This Manikongo, Nzinga Mbemba Afonso, began to write letters to the King João III of Portugal, and he would write in these letters that the problem here is that the Portuguese merchandise that was coming from, you know, Portugal to Africa was what was fueling the trade of African slaves. So he requested, he would write these letters asking the King of Portugal to please stop the outflow of merchandise from Portugal into Africa, to stop the motivation of Africans enslaving other Africans to give them to the Portuguese. And he actually wrote in some of those letters, please don't send merchandise anymore, send us missionaries, which is kind of an interesting thing. He was asking for Christian missionaries. Don't bring us, I'm not sure what goods the Europeans provided to the Africans, but stop bringing your, your guns or your machines or whatever. Bring us missionaries, because when you bring us these goods, it just motivates us to go and enslave and round up people from our own tribes and so to sell them to you. And in one of the letters, I'm going to read what he wrote verbatim. In one of the letters, he said something like, each day the traders are kidnapping our people, children of this country, sons of our nobles and vassals, even people of our own family. This corruption and depravity are so widespread that our land is entirely depopulated. We need in this kingdom only priests and school teachers, and no merchandise unless it's wine and flour for mass. It's our wish that this kingdom not be a place for the trade or transport of slaves. Many of our subjects eagerly lust after Portuguese merchandise that your subjects have brought into our domains. To satisfy this inordinate appetite, they seize many of our black free subjects. They sell them. And after having taken these prisoners secretly or at night, as soon as the captives are in the hands of white men, they are branded with a red hot iron. So that's what he wrote in one of the letters to the King of Portugal. Having said that, it's worth noting that that the Kingdom of Congo did have slavery prior to the Portuguese showing up. And the thing is, they wanted slavery to be regulated, fully regulated by Congoan law. So when the Manikongo, the King of Congo, would hear that the Portuguese were smuggling slaves, without Congoan supervision or control, supervision by the state of Congo, he requested to the King of Portugal, please, control your people, because they are rounding up slaves without our supervision. So yes, he was outraged by what was going on, but it seems like he was more outraged by the excesses that were going on, instead of condemning the whole practice of slavery outright, because he wanted to be able to control it. Also Benin, where the kingdom of Dahomey was, that kingdom grew increasingly rich during the 16th and 17th century, the 1500s and 1600s, because of the slave trade. And the reason why, and that's the reason why in the 1840s, the king, his name, well, it's spelled G-E-Z-O, so I'll pronounce it Gizo or Gezo, King Gezo of Dahomey, in the 1840s, said the following. And if you haven't been paying attention to all that's been said in this audio clip, I hope you can remember remember these parts. He wrote, the King Gezo of Dahomey in the 1840s wrote, "The slave trade is the ruling principle of my people. It's the source and the glory of their wealth. The mother lulls the child to sleep with notes of triumph over an enemy reduced to slavery." And in 1807, that's in the 1840s, think about that. He's saying the slave trade is the ruling principle of my people, and we are becoming wealthy because of it, and we rejoice at the thought of our enemies being sold as slaves to the Europeans. And that's 1840s. Imagine that. By that time, slavery had become a big problem in America, and we were 20 to 30 years away from engaging in a bitter civil war that killed more than half a million Americans, 600,000 Americans, so that we could end slavery. But even then, they were still profiting from it and rejoicing in it, these African black kings, and the people of those kingdoms. And back in 1807, when the UK Parliament passed the bill that abolished slave trade, it didn't abolish slavery, by the way, it just abolished the slave trade. So that meant that there could be no more importing of slaves or movement of slaves, to or from Britain, if I'm not mistaken. And when that happened, when the Parliament passed that bill, the King of Bonny, which is now in Nigeria, there was a kingdom called Bonny, And he was horrified when he heard that. And he wrote, and I'm reading verbatim here, "We think this trade must go on." Remember, this is a black king in Nigeria, in a kingdom in what's modern day Nigeria. And he wrote, "That's the verdict of our oracle and the priest." And this is the thing I'd like you to remember. If you forget everything else we've said so far, remember this quote, because it's at the heart of what we're trying to say in these audio clips about Black America. "That is the verdict of our oracle and the priests. They say that your country," in other words, the UK, "however great, can never stop a trade ordained by God himself." So interesting that, you know, these kings had Christian influence on them. They were African black kings, but they were speaking with a Christian or spiritual or whatever influence. And this fellow was saying, "Oh, it's a shame you're stopping the slave trade. It must go on." And this fellow was not the Dahomey king was a little more materialistic. It's like, "Oh, we need the money. We love the money. We love the goods and services and how wealthy we are and how powerful we're becoming." This guy was speaking from a different perspective. And his perspective was that he was saying our oracle and the priests are saying that it must go on. And he was saying, you, the UK, however great you are, you know, you Britain might think of yourself as Great Britain, but however great you think you are, you cannot stop what God has ordained. So these black kings and many of their subjects believed that it was ordained of God that these black men be sold into slavery to Europeans to be sent to the Americas. And I hope you remember this, because we're going to touch on this. It sounds like a very sinister thing to say, but there's something behind this. And when you get to it, then you begin to understand slavery and why it happened and how we needed to kind of emerge from it. But the problem we've had is we went through slavery, but to this day, I've never heard a single person explain why we went through it. Not a single person. In all my years of existence on the face of the earth, I've never heard anyone explain it. And because we don't explain the root of it, then everything that emanates from that remains muddied and unsolved. And that's why, we have the state of things that we have now. And why Black America went downhill. And as I've said before, Black America collectively as a people will not achieve all the great things that were in store for them. Black America was going to transform the world. They were going to shake the world in such a fundamental way, but they gave it all up. And it was a gradual process, and furthered by the Democrats and by the black bastards who preach in the Christian churches year after year after year, who allowed this slow decay that ended with Black America losing its calling, its collective calling. And I believe they lost it around 7 years ago. It began the day when that horrible night of November the 4th, 2008, when 24 out of every 25 blacks voted for the bastard from Kenya, who didn't have 1 ounce of slave blood in him, who was half white, who represented nothing related to the redemption of black slaves, they sold their souls. They sold their souls that night just to have this horrible mongrel running around the White House claiming to be the president of the United States. And they sold their souls just because he had this skin color that looked like theirs. When he was nothing like them, and he represented nothing about Black America. There was nothing in him that was American or Black American. As you know, his father was born in Kenya. He was not the son of slaves. There was no prophetic or romantic or poetic deliverance in this son of a bitch being put in the White House, because he was not the descendant of slaves who rose out of that, you know, the ashes of slavery to then, you know, become the leader of the country. That would have been the poetic way of redemption. But no, this was this foreigner who impregnated a stupid white bitch in Hawaii, and then gave birth to this little monster boy who ended up then becoming the imposter in chief for 8 years. And when Black America sold their souls just to have a black looking guy in the White House, that was the beginning of the end. And 7 years later, around 7 years later, their calling died. So maybe individual black people may achieve great things, but what was going to happen collectively to all of Black America as a people will never happen, sadly. And it grieves my heart to think about that, because you think of all the suffering that the Black America's ancestors went through, all the heartache, all the torture, all the pain, all the sorrow, all the horrible things they had to endure, their ancestors, to then have the latter generations throw all that sacrifice away. It is so sad. I sometimes grieve in my heart when I think about what Black America gave up, all the great potential that was there to achieve, and they gave it all up, and it will never be recovered. No matter what anyone does, it will never be recovered. I do believe that in some measure that dream, and I hope to see it in my, you know, with my eyes, to see what I would see when I was younger. I would see what Black America was going to achieve. I could see it. I could taste it, and I rejoiced in it. But I hope I can see it with my eyes, at least manifested in some way, with black people outside of America. I think the calling is still alive for the black people in the UK, for the British black people. I believe they can manifest what Black America gave away. And I hope at least to see it in them manifested, not at the same level as it would have been with Black America, but at least I hope to see it collectively manifested in the black people of the UK someday. But even that is slowly dying too, because things are going so bad overall, not just with black people, but in general. So the thing is that we have the situation where Black America is experiencing what it's experiencing because we don't understand the reason for slavery, why it happened, and what was supposed to happen after slavery, and these words, which sound so weird and so harsh and so evil from this king of Boni, hold the key. And to then, so to now begin to understand what this guy was saying, or what is behind it, because maybe literally what he was saying is not technically correct, but he's saying something that hides a truth that we have to get to. And to begin to get to that truth, let's consider how how slavery was supposed to end in America. And so what I call the beginning of the end of slavery in America was on the 21st of April of 1732. And why do I say that? The 21st of April of 1732 was the date when the charter, the corporate charter of the colony of Georgia was granted to a man called James Oglethorpe. And it was granted by the king of, you know, of Britain at the time, George II, the father of George III, you know, the guy from whom the colonies broke off, the American colonies. So George II gave this charter to James Oglethorpe to establish the colony of Georgia, you know, Georgia where Atlanta is. And who was this Oglethorpe? And to kind of answer that, I'm going to be reading a little bit of the things that we have written on the website where these audio snippets are posted. We wrote an article on these things years ago, around 5 years ago. And I'm just going to read some of the things here just out of laziness, just to avoid having to think them out. They're already written down, so I'll just read them here. The colony of Georgia was conceived in the mind and heart of James Oglethorpe, a British soldier and member of parliament who was born in Godalming, Surrey, in 1696. So he was born 4 years before the beginning of the 18th century, you know, the century when America was born as an independent nation. And oddly enough, 1696 happens to be exactly 300 years before the Olympics were held in Georgia in 1996, you know, the Atlanta Olympics in 1996. If I'm not mistaken, I remember it was in 96. So it's 300 years before that, exactly, when James Oglethorpe was born. I'm going to continue reading here. After fighting in the Austro-Turkish War of 1716 through 18 against the Turks, Oglethorpe became an MP, a member of parliament, in 1722 for Haslemere, a town in Surrey. So he was representing this town, and he became an MP in 1722 at the age of around 26. Now, 6 years later, in 1728, he chaired a parliamentary committee that documented the abuses taking place in three debtors' prisons. You know, because in those days, if you owed people money, you could go to jail, go to prison. I don't think that's legal in most countries anymore, but in those days, yeah, if you owed money and you couldn't pay up, you would end up in jail or in prison. So he wrote about the abuses taking place in specifically three debtors' prisons that he apparently investigated. More than simply report on the problem, Oglethorpe determined to do something concrete about it. And it became a burden in his heart to help what he considered the, quote, worthy poor, initially focusing on those in debtors' prisons. And I'm going to continue reading here. The fact that Oglethorpe wanted to focus on the, quote, worthy poor and not just the poor in general reveals that his sense of compassion was not motivated by just pure emotionalism, which is prone to turning in everyone into a helpless victim and never making them accountable for their actions. Oglethorpe understood that the debtors were not, quote, innocent victims, but were in great part responsible for the position they were in by getting into debts that they were unable to cover. Even so, he understood that amongst those people were individuals who deserved a second opportunity to rebuild their lives and work towards prosperity. And then I'm going to continue reading here. Because of his committee's work in Parliament, many debtors were released from prison. but they were released with no means to support themselves, meaning that those who were, quote, worthy were not being given a viable opportunity to rebuild their lives. Oglethorpe saw this as part of a greater problem of unregulated urbanization, which meant, in his mind, that it would be difficult to fashion an immediate solution within the current environment of London and England. Because of this, he conceived the idea of creating a colony in America, which he named Georgia, where these people could relocate and get a new start in a more, quote, non-urban environment. So, as you can see, he had this concept, okay, there's some people who have done wrong and who need to pay for the wrong they did, getting into debts that they were not paying, but also they need an opportunity. There are people amongst these men and women who deserve a second chance, who are worthy of being given an opportunity. So he was not just this compassionate, lovey-dovey guy who said, oh, let's help the poor and the needy. No, no. He said, let's help the poor who are worthy of being helped. And that's very important to understand. It's an important principle. You can never be merciful towards the unjust or the unrighteous. Never. And you say, oh, that's cruel. No, no, no. You have to understand. Let's say that there's a rapist out there. He's around raping women left and right. He doesn't care, about what he's doing. He's just doing it and loving it, loving every minute of it. And are you going to be merciful to them, to that person? Are you going to extend kindness to that person and give them mercy so that he can continue doing his raping? So if you capture him, you're going to go, oh, no, I'm going to be merciful to you and I'm going to let you go. I'm going to let you go so that you can go on raping more women because I am so merciful and kind. That'd be the stupid attitude. If you have him, you have to put him in jail and you have to punish him. The thing is, well, does that mean that you never show mercy to anyone who has done things that are wrong? No. The thing is, if the person is unrighteous but has a change of mind, he repents of his attitudes, he changes his understanding and says, no, I realize that what I did was wrong, then that person goes from a state of unrighteousness to righteousness. And then you can extend your merciful hand towards them and help them and then enable them and empower them. But if you enable them in their state of unrighteousness, then what you're doing is fostering more unrighteousness. You're enabling their evil. It's like if you have a family member who's a drug addict and he's constantly asking you for money so that to feed his habit, and he comes one day and says to you, oh, I can't eat and I have no money, nowhere to sleep and this and that and the other. Can you give me $2,000? And he's done that before and you've given it to him and he goes and wastes it on drugs and things like that. If you keep enabling him and say, oh, yeah, here's the $2,000 because I'm so merciful, then what you're doing is just help, and you do it knowing that he hasn't changed his mind about his drug habit, then all you're doing is enabling him to go and destroy his life further. But if he comes and there's really true repentance, like the prodigal son coming and saying, yes, what I've been doing is evil, please forgive me. I will be your servant and your slave, like the story in the Bible about the prodigal son who came and said, I'm going to be your slave, your servant. I don't deserve to be treated like your son because of what I did. If he comes with that attitude, then you can extend your mercy. Those are the worthy poor, the ones that Oglethorpe saw that needed to be helped. And that's why he created the state of Georgia. And because he created it with that mindset, he did not want slavery there at all. And you have to remember, Georgia was the southernmost colony of all the colonies. So you had slavery in Virginia, which included what is now West Virginia, because West Virginia was part of Virginia. They separated during the Civil War. and North Carolina had slavery, South Carolina had slavery. You know, these states had slavery, and slavery was starting to spread throughout to other territories, you know, to the west of those colonies. And Georgia was the southernmost colony at the time, because Florida was right below it, but Florida was still under Spanish control at the time. But it was the southernmost colony, but when Oglethorpe founded it, most people don't know this, and it's such a sad thing that most people, that the education system is so bad in America that most people don't know this. Sadly, I didn't know this. It took me many years to find this out, which is so sad. And this is not, you know, secret information that, you know, that you have to go to a secret society meeting to discover. It's just plain historical facts, but it's, even though they're plain and easy to find, most people don't know this. But Georgia, when it started, did not have slavery. Slavery was banned from Georgia when it was founded, because Oglethorpe didn't want slavery to come in, because he wanted a society of these small farmers owning their plots of land and working it. But if they brought in slavery, that would kind of defeat the whole purpose of what Georgia was about. Georgia was about giving people who had been doing wrong or had, you know, fallen into debt of some kind, giving them a second chance of freedom and restarting their lives. So bringing in slavery would have just brought in, created the tendency for establishing plantations, these large landowners, and then these petty little people who couldn't, you know, build a life of their own with their own plots of land and so forth. So he saw it that way. And so Georgia, the southernmost colony in what became the U.S., did not have slavery. Slavery was banned in Georgia from its inception in 1732. And unfortunately, that ended in 1751. So Georgia went almost 20 years without slavery. Imagine that, 20 years without slavery. And that's why I know that was the beginning of the end of slavery. That's when the heavenly decree was established on this country saying, you shall end slavery. It was done on the 21st of April, 1732. And we were given a chance to sandwich slavery between free colonies, free states, Georgia in the south, and then the northern states that didn't have slavery. Oh, by the way, Maryland had slavery too, even though it was, Maryland is kind of half in between north and south. And it was part of the North during the Civil War, but Maryland had slavery too, a lot of it. So all the states north of Maryland would have been free, and the southernmost state, Georgia, would have been free, and the evil colonies that had slavery would have been sandwiched in, and it would have been the beginning of the end. If Georgia had been this model of success, then if it had been allowed to become the model of success it was meant to be, then black people would have been slowly freed. And then the plan was that by 1776, or at least 1787, when we wrote the Constitution or drafted it and approved it, then during those, how many years is it? 44 years until 1776, and then some 55, 56 years until 1788. During that period, during that 40, 50 year period, we were supposed to have a gradual end of slavery, because, and now we're getting to why slavery happened. We were saying in the previous audio clip that there was something wrong in Africa. Even before the evil white cracker showed up, there was something wrong in Africa. We were talking about the human sacrifices, the ceremony where this kingdom of Dahomey every year would sacrifice hundreds of people just for the hell of it, and one year they sacrificed like 4,000 people. And you had a lot of slave trading going on back and forth, even before the Portuguese began with this Atlantic slave trade and the trade to India and so forth. There was, and the Arabs were going around enslaving people and doing things. We read some things about how the atrocities that David Livingstone saw with the Arabs trading slaves, mistreating them and killing them willy-nilly. And black people would just watch, and no one did anything about it. There was something wrong in Africa. And we talked in this audio clip about how an African black king told Britain, "How dare you end the slave trade?" We mentioned how the king of Benin or Dahomey was saying slavery is part of our culture. Part of our what makes us rich and wealthy, and what makes us sleep well at night, knowing that we are sending the men of our enemies to the Americas as slaves. There's something wrong there, and then think about the influences. Say, for example, in Haiti. As far as I know, is the first and only country in the world that had a successful slave revolution, and then followed by it, being run by non-whites, after the slave rebellion. Haiti had a big slave rebellion, and they took over. They became basically the first black country, black republic in the Americas. And I don't know if you can call it the first black republic in the world. I don't know if in Africa there had already, they had kingdoms, but I don't think they had like independent republics, at least in that sense of the word. They had monarchies and such, but I don't think they had a republic. But Haiti rose as this first case where the black people rose up and fought and they were free. And you look at Haiti, the poorest country in the Americas, poor as sin, poor as hell. It's pathetic. And every few years, there's some sort of hunger crisis. And then all the white crackers start sending money and aid and food to those evil white crackers, always, helping other people. That's how evil they are. Sending all this food and such to Haiti, and it's a country that seems cursed, and you hear about the things that come from Haiti, and you find out that there's a lot of witchcraft going on in Haiti, voodoo, and all these nasty practices, and all these politicians doing all these things against each other. And oppressing each other and killing each other and all these things, and you go, my goodness, there's something wrong there. And you look at the influence of African values in states like Louisiana here in the U.S. That have a lot of voodoo and all these crazy things. There's something rotten in Denmark. But in this case, it's not Denmark, it's Africa. There's something rotten in Africa. There's something not right. And when you think about how they were selling each other and how they would just stand back and not help their brothers, really help, because even the king of that we were reading, who wrote to the king of Portugal saying, please don't send us merchandise, send us missionaries. He had the power. He could have acted and said, okay, hey, this is our country, and we're going to control this, and we're going to put an end to this nonsense about slavery. He didn't do it. So there was a certain As you look at the history of Black Africa, you see that there's something wrong, and there is a certain selfishness, and it's and that is at the heart of it. And we're slowly running out of time. I think we'll talk about this more in the next audio clip, but just to get this point across, Black America is kind of endowed with a strong impartation of the visionary personality. That's what makes Black people so good and successful in the music business and artistic things, because the visionaries are they are free-flowing emotionally. They are creators and innovate and do things out of the box and so forth. And visionaries have this tendency also to be very sacrificial. They give themselves, it's like they pour themselves emotionally into a cause, and often they are willing to die for it. And they get lost in the emotion of their cause. And Black people have that. But the weird and sad thing is that Black people have used that visionary gift that they have, and they immerse themselves into their music or even in athletics and things like that. And it's like a natural thing for them to do. And they do it when they first of all, it's the natural thing to do. And second, when they know that it benefits them. Then they're comfortable doing it, and there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is, for some reason, Black people have this problem that they have a hard time giving of themselves for others. Even when they are born with the visionary trait quality that would make them the perfect people who to give themselves in this loving, willing sacrifice for other people. But when there is no benefit for them, it's like they stop. And I'm not saying every Black person is like that. I'm saying there's a pattern there. And it's as if they don't want to give of themselves for other people. They do give of themselves and pour themselves out emotionally in their visionary attitudes when it's natural for them or beneficial or makes them happy, but never for the sake of others. And that's why, Black communities don't help each other. You, when the Chinese, in San Francisco, the Chinese would come and land in California. All the Chinese people would help each other. Did you know that I used to go to a Chinese benevolence place to learn Chinese? My father would take me there when I was a kid. Did you know that in many cities they have these Chinese benevolence organizations, and it's like Chinese contributing money to these organizations, and then these organizations would help Chinese people in need or teach Chinese to the children of Chinese people, like in my case, and so and they would help each other. So if someone came from China, he would get help. By other from other Chinese people, and the Chinese are not that sacrificial. Believe you me, they are not that kind and loving, lovey-dovey. But even they would help each other, and you don't see that in Black America. It's like everyone for on his own. It's not my problem. If it doesn't benefit me, I'm not going to get involved. The utmost selfishness, and it's as if the decree against Black people was, okay, you are supposed to give naturally yourself and sacrifice for others, but because you refuse to do that, then I'm going to force you to give of yourself to others against your will. And that's when slavery came in. And that's when Black people had to give of themselves in sacrifice. And that's when Black people came to America, they began to give of themselves in this horrible sacrifice, so that their children could have a better future than they could possibly have in Africa. Think of all the Black people in America. I'm pretty sure none of them would ever want to be living in the conditions that they would be living in Africa had their ancestors, you know, stayed there, not been drugged here, and suffered through all the heartache that they suffered through. And now they have the opportunity to buy $400 Nike sneakers and do all these things and that they would couldn't possibly enjoy if they had been left behind back in Africa. So it's as if it was this divine decree. You are going to give of yourself. Because you refuse to do it, I will force it on you. And that's how they ended up here. So it's like black people were here as slaves in a form of a very harsh debtor's prison. But then it was going to be just for a period. And then in 1732, the divine ordinance came on this country and said, debtor's prison is out. The year of Jubilee has come. You have to let your brothers free. You have to let the brothers free. Let your brothers free. Your black brothers and sisters free. And America didn't do it. And we're going to explain a little more of what happened, why Georgia ended up, you know, embracing slavery. And then we went downhill from there. But we were supposed to start the end of slavery in 1732. By 1776, it would have been kind of declared official. We are going to end slavery. And then by 1788, when the Constitution was written and approved, we were supposed to be a slavery-free nation. And it would have been possible had there been the willingness as a nation to do it. It was possible. It was because we had a colony in the South that was completely slave-free for 20 years. So don't tell me it was not possible. It was possible. But certain idiots began to influence things and turn us in the wrong direction. We're going to talk about one of those idiots in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much for listening.